Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow for time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop Treatment Update on Soft Tissue Sarcoma. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and I also particularly would like to call out to the organizations that are specifically focused on sarcoma, so the Sarcoma Alliance and the Sarcoma Foundation of America, who really have worked hard to help to promote this program. And because of all of this collaboration and your interest in the topic today, we have on the call over 507 participants. And you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Italy, and the United Kingdom. So it's really a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And today's program is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC, and by a contribution from Lilly. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program today, but also for their corporate partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Catherine Thornton. Dr. Thornton is co-clinical director, Center for Sarcoma and Bone Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Thornton is going to address an overview of soft tissue sarcoma, current standard of care and new treatment approaches, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns, including symptom management. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Thornton.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you, everybody, for joining today. I'm going to give a brief overview of soft tissue sarcoma, something I'm sure all of you are well acquainted with, and I'm going to touch on many of its different facets, including, as Dr. Messner mentioned, symptom management, and then just touch upon some of the new treatment approaches that have come about over the last several years, as well as sort of the long-term standard of care. So soft tissue sarcoma is a very, very broad category of tumors. There's about 13,000 new cases diagnosed every year in the United States. They make up about 1% of all cancers in adults and about 15% of cancers in pediatric malignancies. And they're oftentimes plagued with misdiagnosis and misclassification, which leads to underreporting. And so we're not really sure whether that 12,000 is an accurate number. Sarcomas are linked to cells that lead to the development of the tissues in our bodies that form the connective tissue. And as such, sarcomas can develop anywhere in our bodies from head to toe. They are made up of all different types of cell types, including blood vessel cells, soft tissue cells, muscle cells, skeletal muscle cells, smooth muscle cells, and can occur in all different parts of our bodies, including the head and neck, the upper extremities, the lower extremities, the back and abdomen, and our trunk, including our chest. There are about 18% of the soft tissue sarcomas are made up of a tumor called gastrointestinal stromal tumor, which is a soft tissue sarcoma usually of the GI tract. There is a classification called undifferentiated high-grade pleomorphic sarcoma, which is a subtype, liposarcoma, leiomyosarcoma. These are all rare tumors if you look at cancer as a broad category as a whole, but within the soft tissue sarcoma realm, they make up some of the more common sarcomas that we are faced with. So what has been the standard of care over the last 40-plus years? First and foremost, it's surgery. If someone's diagnosed with a soft tissue sarcoma and it's localized to one location, the number one thing we want to do is get it out. And Dr. Rout is going to speak with you much more detail about that a little bit later on. And that was probably the first therapy that we've been using since the, 1700s, 1800s for these types of tumors. Around the 1950s, radiation therapy started being used, and Dr. Delaney, my respected colleague, is going to speak about that with regards to soft tissue sarcoma. And it wasn't until the 1970s and 1971, to be specific, that we really started to focus on chemotherapy. And we've looked at chemotherapy's use in soft tissue sarcoma in anywhere from its use for tumors that have traveled to other areas outside of the primary location versus its use in the setting of you've had a soft tissue sarcoma and now it's been taken out, do we use chemotherapy or not? The number one drug that we've been using for the longest period of time is a drug called doxorubicin. It's an IV chemotherapy, and doxorubicin's been paired with just about every chemotherapy under the sun. We will oftentimes use it by itself, or we'll use it in combination with another IV chemotherapy called ifosfamide. And although we really look to the specific type of sarcoma to guide whether that's appropriate therapy or not, that's really been one of the main players with treatment for 40 years. We were starting to kind of lose faith that we were at a standstill with therapies, but over the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen the introduction of several new agents, which has really diversified the treatment options and provided a lot of hope for patients. In 2011, a drug called pazopanib was approved for soft tissue sarcoma. This is an oral drug. It targets something called vascular endothelial growth factor receptor, which is something that can be expressed on the blood vessels of tumors, and became the first drug approved for sarcoma since doxorubicin in 1971. Then, even more recently, in 2015, there was the approval by the FDA of a drug called trabectedin. Trabectedin was approved in 2007 in Europe and is approved in other countries as well, but finally gained FDA approval in 2015 for the treatment of metastatic leiomyosarcoma and liposarcoma. And so that's become a very commonly used drug in those diseases and others that we have a little bit of a track record with. Following the approval of trabectedin, there was a drug called eribulin, which was approved in early 2016 for the treatment of liposarcoma. This was a drug that was approved several years ago for the treatment of breast cancer, but looks particularly effective in liposarcoma and probably has some efficacy in a drug called in the tumor leiomyosarcoma as well. And then the newest kid on the block was a drug that was approved only a mere few weeks ago by the FDA. It was given something called an accelerated approval, which means that the studies that have been done so far have shown it to be an exciting drug, a drug that has a lot of possibility, but the drug company is going to be faced with doing a couple of more trials to prove that it's a drug worthy of staying on the market. And that drug's called alirocumab, and got approval on, I believe, October 19th. And it's being used in combination with doxorubicin in the treatment of metastatic soft tissue sarcomas that would otherwise be treated with doxorubicin as a single agent. So these are just some of the drugs that have come out recently and just a small example of how much progress has been made over the last 5 years and how we're hopeful that there'll be even more progress made in the years to come. Symptom management was something that I was asked to speak upon, and as you can imagine, given that these tumors can arise from pretty much any part of our body, the symptoms can be diverse. Primarily the types of symptoms that come about from the chemotherapies that we use are some of the things that as medical oncologists we spend a lot of our time focusing on. We work with our nurses to hear about how patients are doing and try to work with the anti-emetic drugs or the anti-nausea medications that we have to improve a patient's quality of life while they're getting chemotherapy. I'm happy to answer questions about this because it's a very broad category, but we use a combination of anti-nausea medications in a preventative type of way. We use pain medications. We use just good old-fashioned get out and exercise techniques, you know, meditation, massage, all kinds of alternative therapies that can complement a patient's experience while they're on therapy, all to help them get through all of the things that they need to get through. So I think with that, I'll probably wind up my brief discussion and introduction into soft tissue sarcomas and turn it back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Thornton. That was really outstanding and really, really set the tone for the whole program today and giving people a much clearer picture of just the complexity of soft tissue sarcoma, how it's treated. And so thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Dr. Thomas Delaney. Dr. Delaney is the Andres Soriano Professor of Radiation Oncology, Harvard Medical School, Radiation Oncologist, Department of Radiation Oncology. He's also Medical Director, Francis H. Burr Proton Therapy Center, and he's Co-Director, Center for Sarcoma and Connective Tissue Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Delaney is going to address the role of radiation oncology, the types of radiation treatments, and clinical trials, and how research contributes to your treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Delaney.
Thank you, Carolyn. Radiation is often used in conjunction with surgery and at times chemotherapy for the treatment of sarcomas. Radiation is often needed at the site of the origin of the sarcoma because there can be a microscopic extension beyond the visible tumor that the surgeon sees and removes. If one attempted to do more radical surgery to eradicate this microscopic disease beyond the visible tumor, there can be a risk for further loss of limb function in patients who have tumors that arise in the limbs. And in some locations, many abdominal locations and sarcomas in the head and neck region, for example, it's really not possible to obtain wide margins. So radiation can be an important component of the local treatment of the tumor. Radiation therapy refers to the use of high-energy X-rays or other particles to destroy cancer cells. The doctors who specialize in giving radiation therapy are called radiation oncologists. Since sarcoma is rare, it's very important to talk with a radiation oncologist who has experience treating sarcomas. Because the radiation doses that are required to sterilize microscopic disease are lower than those required to eradicate visible tumor, the combination of removal of the visible tumor by the surgeon in conjunction with a radiation dose that can eliminate microscopic disease results in a local control, which means permanent eradication of the tumor in the overwhelming majority of patients who have tumors that arise in the arms and the legs with generally good functional result. That being said, there are also some smaller sarcomas, generally those that occur in the thigh and particularly those that are less aggressive under the microscope that can be very well treated with surgery with a wide margin, and Dr. Rout will discuss that further. And such patients would not necessarily need any radiation treatment. In addition, however, there are also some patients with sarcomas in the head and neck region, the spine, where cancer surgery or to obtain a wide margin would be difficult. And in fact, even removal of the tumor you can see can be problematic. And so some patients will have tumors that aren't amenable to a good operation. And radiation can be considered as an alternative to surgery in those patients, although it usually requires very high doses of radiation and sophisticated radiation techniques. So we do always try to do surgery whenever possible. There are different kinds of radiation treatments. The most common is called external beam radiation therapy. The radiation is given with a machine that's outside the body, and the alternative is something called brachytherapy, which is where internal radiation sources are placed in close proximity to the tumor. the radiation treatment schedule usually consists of a specific number of radiation treatments that are often given 5 days a week for 5 to 6 weeks, either before or after surgery. As I mentioned, the radiation is often done before surgery to sterilize tumor cells at the margin of the visible tumor. This can often allow for smaller radiation fields for tumors that arise in the arms and the legs compared to giving the radiation after surgery, where we generally try to encompass the surgical scars and the surgical drains. Radiation at times in conjunction with chemotherapy may also facilitate the removal of a large sarcoma, or as I mentioned, it can also be done after surgery to remove cancer cells that may have been left behind. We often consider radiation as a technique that can allow the surgeon to do a lesser surgical procedure, a less radical surgical procedure, which allows preservation of critical structures in the arm and the leg if the tumor is arising in one of those sites. Nevertheless, radiation therapy can also affect normal cells, but because we tend to focus it around the tumor, the side effects are limited to those areas, and I'll give a brief discussion about the potential side effects that can occur during radiation treatment. It's important to recognize for patients that new radiation techniques have developed over the last 15 years that have improved our ability to treat the tumor and spare the normal tissue. Some of these include what's referred to as intensity-modulated radiation therapy, and another is called proton therapy. Intensity-modulated radiation therapy uses many small beams of radiation that turn on and off as the machine rotates around the body. It is frequently now used for patients with sarcomas. As a result, there are fewer side effects during treatment than there were in the past, as well as fewer late side effects of radiation therapy. Side effects that can occur during radiation therapy are related to the site that is being treated, so they are really specific to the anatomic area where the tumor is arising. But as sort of a general statement about possible side effects, there can be some fatigue, mild skin reaction. If patients have abdominal tumors, you can have nausea related to treatment, and at times some loosening of bowel movements. In the short term, radiation therapy can cause some redness of the skin that looks like a sunburn. We have creams that can reduce this and helps with any discomfort related to irritation of the skin. Radiation therapy can have an impact on wound healing, and the surgeon and the radiation oncologist work together to try to reduce the risk of wound healing problems. In patients who have tumors, particularly of the legs, radiation therapy in conjunction with surgery can cause some thickening of the tissues, but that usually does not have an impact on function, although some patients who have tumors in the groin may have some swelling of the leg if it's a large tumor that requires a dissection in the groin region. One rare side effect of radiation therapy, but it is an important one in patients who do get treated, is the rare risk of a second tumor related to the radiation therapy. This is unfortunately a rare event, but it is something that we continue to monitor patients for after treatment is done, and physicians and patients are encouraged to discuss the potential risk of a second malignancy related to radiation with their treating physician. One more recent radiation technique is called proton beam radiation. It uses charged particles. They radiate about half as much normal tissue as standard radiation, and these can have a role, particularly for large sarcomas in young patients, to reduce the late side effects of radiation treatment on normal tissues. The other technique that's been used for treatment of sarcomas is what's called brachytherapy, which is refers to the insertion of radiation seeds through small tubes called catheters directly into the affected area of the body. For sarcomas, this is generally done in the operating room at the time of the surgical removal of the tumor, it can allow a shorter course of radiation, which can make treatment more convenient for some patients, and it provides a very localized radiation dose just around the catheters. Nevertheless, it requires specialized skills and special training, and it's usually only done in certain hospitals with experience with this technique. The setup for the brachytherapy usually, as I mentioned, starts in the operating room where catheters are placed at the time of the surgical removal of the tumor into the tumor bed. And then several days later, radiation sources are placed once or twice a day into the catheters by a machine in the radiation oncology department. And this is usually done for 4 to 5 days. And then the catheters are removed. One other specialized technique is what's referred to as intraoperative radiation. This approach can deliver highly localized radiation to an area of a normal tissue that's adjacent to a tumor that that normal tissue cannot be removed. And at the time of surgery, when other normal tissues are moved out of the way, you can deliver radiation to the area abutting the tumor while allowing some normal tissue, such as bowel, to be excluded from the radiation fields. One other recent technique we've begun to use in patients is what's called stereotactic body radiation. The patient is rigidly immobilized, and radiation is directed through many fields and highly focused on what are usually small areas of tumor that have spread either to lung, liver, or bone. And with the highly focused radiation, you can often permanently control those sites of spread of tumor as an alternative to surgical procedure. In the last couple of minutes, I'll just make a mention of clinical trials and how research contributes to treatment options. The local treatment of soft tissue sarcomas that arise in the arms or legs is extremely effective with a combination of surgery and radiation for most patients. It's very uncommon these days to have patients have a local recurrence at the site where the tumor arises in the arms or legs. Nevertheless, patients who have tumors that appear aggressive under the microscope, we call these high-grade tumors, and in particular, tumors that are larger than a couple inches in size do have a risk of spread of tumor to distant sites, particularly the lungs. Conventional chemotherapy approaches have shown some benefit, although relatively modest benefit. And because of that, we are testing new treatment approaches in clinical trials, which allows us to test treatment strategies that have shown promise in the lab and patients. For extremity sarcomas, currently these include testing targeted chemotherapies aimed at dysregulated cell growth pathways in the tumor, as well as immunologic approaches. We're now beginning to look at molecules called checkpoint inhibitors that allow the immune system to attack the tumor, which have shown benefits in other tumors, including melanomas and lung cancers. And both the immunotherapy approaches and targeted chemotherapy approaches are being combined with preoperative radiation and surgery for patients who have extremity sarcomas, and will be compared to the standard preoperative radiation and surgery in these patients. For patients who have tumors that arise in the abdomen, the area of the back part of the abdomen called the retroperitoneum, it's difficult for the surgeon to obtain a wide margin, and Dr. Rout will discuss this shortly. There is an ongoing study comparing the outcome of preoperative radiation and surgery compared to surgery alone, and we think that's an important study to define the best treatment strategy for patients who have abdominal sarcomas. And there's another ongoing study which is looking at trying to give even higher doses of radiation to the areas of close margins in normal tissues that can't be removed at the time of surgical resection of abdominal sarcomas. So that's another approach which is being done in clinical trials as a way of hoping to improve the outcome in patients. I think I'll stop at this point and turn the program back to Carolyn to have Dr. Rout discuss surgery for sarcomas.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Andolani. That was really superb, I have to say, and very comprehensive and really very detail-oriented. I think people have a much firmer understanding of the various roles of radiation treatment and how it makes a big difference. And also, so thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, but thank you for this really very excellent presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Chandrajit Raut. Dr. Raut is with the Division of Surgical Oncology, Brigham and Women's Hospital. He is Director of Surgical Oncology, Center for Sarcoma and Bone Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He's Associate Professor of Surgery, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Raut is going to present the role of surgery in the treatment of soft tissue sarcoma, the importance of the pathology report, and pain management. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Raut.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner, and I really appreciate this opportunity to speak today. And I'll pick up on several of the themes that Dr. Thornton and Dr. Delaney have also brought up. Just to take a step back, as Dr. Thornton mentioned, one of the principal roles for trying to eradicate the tumor really falls to surgery. And when someone has a soft tissue sarcoma that has not spread to any other sites, our main goal is to get the tumor out. We use systemic therapy, meaning chemotherapy, and radiation therapy, sometimes prior to surgery in an effort to facilitate an operation, to make the scope of the operation a little bit smaller, and to try to reduce the chance of local recurrence. But ultimately, if someone has a single-sided disease that has not spread, our goal is to get the tumor out as the main curative approach. The way we focus our surgical planning depends on several key factors. The traditional factor has been really site of origin. As Dr. Thornton mentioned, there are only about 13,000 new diagnoses of sarcoma per year, and so it's a rare tumor. And furthermore, there are more than 70 different major types of sarcoma. Each has its own behavior, and they, in a sense, behave as differently from each other as, say, colon cancer differs from prostate cancer and from lung cancer. So we're really talking about 70 individual diseases, and we as sarcoma researchers and clinicians really try to educate our own colleagues to think of sarcoma not as a single disease, but really as a family of very often unrelated diseases that present very unique treatment requirements. So we do think about where the sarcoma has started. Is it in the extremity, meaning the arms or legs, or trunk? Is it in the abdomen? And even within the abdomen, there's really four major compartments. There's the visceral or abdominal cavity, the peritoneal cavity, which includes most of the major hollow organs, the stomach, the small intestine, parts of the colon. It also includes the liver. Then there's retroperitoneum. There's two sides. There's one on the left and one on the right. And the reason we make a distinction is that organs that sit in front of them differ from the left to the right side. And so we have the left retroperitoneal compartment that includes the tail end of the pancreas, the kidney, and on the right side it includes part of the small intestine, the right kidney, and the head of the pancreas. And so those are, again, very different anatomic relationships that I think about as the surgeon considering an operation. And finally, there's the pelvic compartment, which is also very separate. That includes the bladder, the uterus, and the rectum, and again, a different site for sarcomas to originate. In addition to the abdomen, retroperitoneum, and pelvis, and the extremity and trunk, we have sarcomas that can arise in the chest cavity, meaning the bony or muscular part of the chest, as well as in the lungs. Those and it often can spread to the lungs from other sites, and we treat those as well. And then sarcomas can arise in the head and neck region, either deeper inside in the muscles or more superficially on the skin, and they can also arise in the breast in women. And so we really initially try to think about what operation a patient needs based on where the tumor arises. The other very important consideration is what specific type of sarcoma is this? And the treatment that the operation that I might do for sarcoma type A arising in a particular muscle may differ from sarcoma type B because of the pattern of behavior or the difference in behavior of these two different sarcomas. Just to use an example, myxofibrosarcoma is a sarcoma that arises in the arms and legs, typically in older adults. it has a higher risk of recurring locally in the arms or legs than most other sarcomas that arise in the arms or legs, and it has a lower risk of spreading to other sites. So as a result, we tend to do a little bit more of an aggressive operation, taking wider margins, because this tumor can have finger-like or some microscopic extensions well out into the surrounding tissue beyond what you can see on an MRI or what you can feel on clinical exam. And so we tend to have to do a wider margin. We also typically are very aggressive about radiation therapy for this tumor. And whereas other sarcomas that tend not to have that infiltrative nature, that tend to be just more sort of pushing tissue out of the way, we don't necessarily have to get as high, as large of a margin, even if that's rising the same place. So we really try to look at both histology and site of origin in determining our treatment. Other considerations that we think about, some tumors like desmoid tumors can be very aggressive locally, but they're essentially benign in the sense that they do not metastasize. That doesn't mean that they may not be very problematic. They can be very tenacious at coming back at the same spot. They can cause some pain, and there's also been a significant change in the way we manage these tumors. Because they don't spread, we tend to be a little less aggressive about surgery than we had been in the past. We tend to use radiation therapy less often. We can often just start by watching these tumors. They don't necessarily all need an operation, and sometimes they can actually get smaller on their own or even go away in a very small percentage of people. Sometimes these desmoid tumors can arise in different settings. They can arise in the setting of a genetic condition, which requires frequent colonoscopies due to an associated risk of colon cancer, or they can arise in the setting of pregnancy, and those tend to do very well. And so we factor those additional demographic bits of information into our treatment recommendations. Another type of sarcoma that is the most common type, gastrointestinal stromal tumor, has very different patterns of recurrence. Gastrointestinal stromal tumors are GIST, typically arise in the intestines or stomach. The most common site is the stomach, then the small intestine and the colon and esophagus are the next most common sites. And this tumor, unlike other sarcomas and also unlike other carcinomas like colon cancer or breast cancer, has a very low risk of recurring locally. So usually when you take out, when someone has a colon cancer, they need a certain margin of normal colon on either side to reduce the risk of local recurrence. We don't need that for GIST, and we can do a much smaller operation, taking out only a portion of an organ instead of a larger amount. And that's simply because these tumors do not recur locally. We typically do favor getting a preoperative diagnosis before we treat any, or actually a diagnosis or a biopsy at diagnosis or presentation, because sometimes we will consider chemotherapy or radiation therapy before surgery, and so we don't wait until the tumor is removed before getting a diagnosis. And I think that this is something that almost every major sarcoma center emphasizes, but we see in the community that surgeons will often go and remove a tumor first and get the diagnosis later, and we feel very strongly that the diagnosis is important to obtain up front because of treatment planning. For instance, we will do a needle biopsy of a tumor in the retroperitoneum and then decide, should we get radiation, should this person get radiation therapy or not, or should we consider, if this is a GIST, should we consider giving drug therapy up front to try to shrink the tumor down in an effort to facilitate the operation. So we do emphasize the importance of getting a preoperative biopsy. One of the points I was asked to discuss was the importance of the pathology report, and I can't underemphasize this. I can't overemphasize this enough. I think in our minds that the pathologic diagnosis is very critical in our management. And our pathologists are an integral part of our team. We think that this team approach is very critical, and the pathologists are often our first line of planning. We find that in our own experience, we change the diagnosis in about 25% of patients who present to our sarcoma center from the diagnosis that was given to them at their original hospital. And this is often because, just like as you've heard from Dr. Thornton and Dr. Delaney, there's a lot of expertise in the delivery of chemo and radiation therapy for sarcomas that's different from other cancers. The same is true for the pathologic diagnosis. And the pathologist who sees sarcomas all the time is more likely to render the correct diagnosis. So we review the pathology for every patient that is new to our center. Once we have that pathologic diagnosis, then we meet as a team, pathology, radiation oncology, medical oncology, surgical oncology, or orthopedic oncology, and our radiologists themselves, who also really understand sarcomas, and we come up with what we think is the most ideal treatment for a patient. And that sometimes includes multiple options where one is not superior to another. As Dr. Delaney mentioned, sometimes we give radiation therapy before surgery and sometimes we give it after surgery, and there's different side effects and different consequences from each approach, but the long-term oncologic outcome is not necessarily any different, meaning that the rate of local recurrence or distant spread is not different based on whether the radiation was given before or after surgery. The goal of surgery tends to be getting a negative margin, and that's a little bit different for GIST and a little bit different for desmoids. But otherwise, we really attempt to get a wide negative margin to reduce the chance of local recurrence. How I like to sequence in radiation or systemic therapy can differ. For instance, when we use radiation therapy, the rationale is to reduce the risk of local recurrence. And as you heard from Dr. Delaney, it's not necessarily going to change too often the scope of the operation. I still need to get a wide margin, and I don't expect the tumor to shrink very much with radiation therapy. If it does, that's great, but it doesn't necessarily change my treatment approach. So I do want to get a wide margin, and we use radiation therapy to help reduce that risk of local recurrence. For GIST, as I mentioned before, we have a drug that can be very effective at shrinking the tumor before surgery, and that we like to use if it's going to downstage the approach to an operation. It usually doesn't change how much of the stomach or how much of the small intestine I need to remove, but it might allow me to do an operation that instead of having to do an open operation that has a longer recovery, I might be able to do it laparoscopically. So we try to sequence in neoadjuvant or preoperative chemotherapy or radiation therapy to facilitate how an operation might be conducted and the impact on each individual patient and on its impact on long-term outcomes in terms of when the cancer might recur. Now, one other point I was asked to mention is pain and symptom management, and this is a challenging area because for individuals who have recurrent sarcomas, the role of surgery is debatable. I think that we have to really individualize our treatment to each person, depending on what type of sarcoma they had originally, where it's recurred, what's the pattern of recurrence, is it a single site, is it 5 years after their original presentation versus 6 months, how is that person looking overall? Are they, are they in relatively good health, or are they do they have a lot of other medical problems that could complicate recovery from an operation? And what are their symptoms? Sometimes surgery can relieve symptoms without necessarily removing all the tumor. One area where we tend to be very aggressive about surgery, even for recurrent disease, is for bowel obstruction. And many other types of cancers, including colon cancer, bowel obstruction is has a very poor prognosis. With sarcoma, we know that relief of this symptom and control of the pain from bowel obstruction can have very good long-term outcomes on an individual basis. And at our institution, we actually carefully triage individual cancer patients with bowel obstruction based on the type of tumor that they have. And patients with sarcoma tend to come to us on our sarcoma team because we'll be much more aggressive about surgery because we think that that not only will help relieve their symptoms in the short term, but actually can have, in limited cases, some very important long-term benefit. I think I'll stop there and turn it back over to Dr. Messner.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roth. That was really outstanding and very comprehensive as well, and just really giving everyone a very clear sense of how a surgical approach is used in treating soft tissue sarcoma. So thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. We are already getting questions in, and we haven't even told people how to queue up for questions. So this is there are lots of questions I can see here. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Kelly. Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker, and she is an older adult program coordinator at Cancer Care. And she'll be addressing Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name is Sarah Kelly. As Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. And we've been talking today about sarcoma. We've been talking about managing your care and quality of life. And I'd like to talk now about speaking really about the importance of creating a support network as part of that care and how Cancer Care can be a part of your network. So just a little bit about us. We're a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer care programs include individual counseling, which we provide face-to-face in the New York area and then over the phone nationally. We have support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in New York. We do it over the phone nationally. And we also provide the groups online, both nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one we're on today. We also provide practical help. We can assist you navigate the healthcare system. We also have some financial assistance available. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. And oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, so his or her support network. We're also trained to help patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease, financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and overall psychological impact and care. And I find that adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis in the areas I just mentioned is an important part of the healing process, and I actually consider it to be a part of treatment. So as you know, cancer affects the whole person, right? It's not just the body, but it's also the mind and the emotions. Asking for help by joining a support group or contacting a social worker for counseling can be so important as part of your treatment plan and really is a sign of strength. You don't have to do this alone. You know, if you're in a support group, you can connect with others who are going through a similar situation or experiencing similar problems. Individual counseling really provides a space that's just yours to voice any concerns and navigate any of the issues I mentioned earlier. And these connections can help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. And again, I think feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and is an important part of treatment. At this time, Cancer Care is offering a number of support groups, both face-to-face support groups, telephone support groups, and the online support groups. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, call us. You can call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE, and that's 1-800-813-4673. Or visit our website. We have an incredibly comprehensive website, and that's www.cancercare.org. And you'll find a lot of information not only on support but also on all of our programs, as well as your diagnosis, treatment, and just ways of coping as you go through this. There's been a lot of information on today's program. We've got a lot of great information to digest and kind of get your arms around. We're here to help you understand what it means for you and for your loved ones. If you have any questions about today's workshop or about our services, you know, don't hesitate to contact us. And lastly, I really want to stress that you're not alone in this. You do not have to walk the path alone. Our services are here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Kelly. That was really just wonderful, as always, and thank you for just identifying these support services for people. And now we have time for questions, and we have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible, and if we don't get your question by the end of the call, I will give you resources to get your questions answered. But let's see how many we can take, and actually, Candace, if you could bring all of our speakers on board, and also if you could explain to our participants how to queue up and ask questions, even though some are doing this already. Thanks.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And again, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1.
So we have a question for one of our online participants, and it's a question for Dr. Delaney. What is the current use of proton therapy for soft tissue sarcomas? Can or is proton therapy an option for retroperitoneal tumor locations? So, Dr. Delaney, if you could address this question in a general way, that would probably be helpful here. Thank you.
Protons are being used in centers where protons are available for young patients, certainly many pediatric patients who have soft tissue sarcomas. With regard to retroperitoneal sarcomas, the data for the use for radiation therapy is actually still being developed. As mentioned earlier, that unlike extremity sarcomas where we have studies where patients have been randomly assigned to receive surgery alone or surgery and radiation with the outcome of those studies showing that radiation improves the local control for tumors arising in the extremity. For retroperitoneal sarcoma, a similar study was attempted in the United States, and it didn't complete accrual, and there's an ongoing study in Europe in which half of the patients are assigned to receive radiation before surgery, and half of the patients receive surgery alone. So that study is nearly completed, but we don't know for certain whether radiation improves the local control of tumors in the retroperitoneum. That being said, there are some studies that suggest that, and at least in this country, when we had tried to run a study which didn't get completed, we went on to develop a study in which we are treating patients with radiation before surgery and trying to give a higher dose to the areas that it's hardest for the surgeon to remove. And that study has an arm of using protons and another arm using intensity-modulated X-rays, and that's being done in a clinical trial setting at approximately 6 institutions around the country. And the study can be accessed through clinicaltrials.gov, which is the government's website to provide information about ongoing clinical studies.
Excellent. And there's one other question for you. Right now, actually, Dr. Delaney, another question about radiation. Should radiation play a role in adult desmoplastic small round cell tumor after debulking surgery?
The desmoplastic round cell tumors are a very challenging sarcoma that arise in the abdomen, and I'll ask Dr. Routes and Dr. Thornton to comment as well. These often arise in young patients, often adolescents, and they're one of the most challenging tumors that we face. The current sequence of treatment often involves chemotherapy and then an attempt at surgery to remove as much of the tumor as can be done. The tumors are often multifocal. There's some information about using high-dose, using intra-abdominal warmed, heated chemotherapy at the time of the surgical procedure, and then afterwards an attempt to radiate the entire abdomen. The treatment to date has been less successful than we would like, but at least the best results that are reported appear to combine all of the available elements of treatment, including chemotherapy to start, aggressive surgery, possibly with some intra-abdominal chemotherapy, followed by radiation treatment.
Thank you very much. Dr. Routh, yes.
Yeah, I'll comment on that as well. I think Dr. Delaney hit the nail on the head. This is a very a particularly challenging subtype of sarcoma. And in fact, for those of you who are aware that there's an international conference every year, which we all just got back from this past weekend, and there was one session devoted to desmoplastic small round cell sarcoma. And the data that Dr. Delaney mentioned was described and reviewed. And this is one of the few, perhaps the only type of sarcoma where there may be some benefit to heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy. Mostly this is essentially a disease that at initial presentation is already multifocal. This is it's one of the few where we don't see just a single-sided disease initially that then spreads. So it's challenging from the outset. Most of the people who have this disease are tend to be young, and several centers that treat pediatric sarcomas have been aggressive about using heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy together with a very extensive operation to as well as chemotherapy before or after to try to improve the outcomes of this disease. And one of the concepts that was brought up and discussed last week in great detail was the data from some centers about use of whole abdominal radiation therapy. I think that we're all looking to figure out a way to treat this particular tumor better, and it does require the input of all disciplines. And we still have a lot of work to do, and we still don't have the silver bullet to really get this disease under good control.
Thank you. And Dr. Thornton, did you want to comment as well?
I think Dr. Delaney and Dr. Rout have covered the basis with desmoplastic small round cell, but the big overriding take-home message in my eyes is this is a fantastic example of a disease that's so exceedingly rare that if a patient has the opportunity to get themselves to a high-volume center where they really will be approached with, you know, a multidisciplinary game plan, that's probably the best thing that they can do for themselves.
Well, could you say a little bit more about the high volume centers in terms of identifying them? Because that's really, I think that's such an important message for all of you on the call today, just to have an awareness of that.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the centers that are scattered across the United States, and, you know, sadly, there's not a ton of them. So it does submit a little bit of a logistical challenge for patients that live in more remote areas. But these are centers that have dedicated teams of physicians that do nothing except treat sarcoma. Dr. Rout, Dr. Delaney, and myself are all sort of centered at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. There's a handful of other ones across the U.S. It's not just the people that the patients are meeting with, the surgeons like Dr. Rout, the medical oncologists like myself, and the radiation oncologists like Dr. Delaney, but it's all the behind-the-scenes people, in addition to the clinicians that they meet. So it's the pathologists that are looking at their tissue under the microscope. It's the radiologists that are reading the CT scans or the MRIs. It's the molecular pathologists that are, you know, doing special tests. And, you know, the social workers and the counselors that are adept to dealing with the challenges of rare tumors and the unique needs that that our patient population entail.
So this, we have at least you have a representation today from a particular center, which might be a good point to contact in terms of identifying centers that might be closer to where you are and where you live. That would be a reasonable thing to think of doing. And now we have, I guess, a telephone question. So should we take the telephone question as well?
Our question comes from the line of Christine G. Your line is now open.
I have a question about irreversible electroporation or nanoknife treatment for the radiologist oncologist. What's the efficacy of that? Can you talk about that treatment?
Thank you very much.
Oh. It's not a treatment that that I do, and it's not a standard treatment.
Thank you. Okay, so that might be Christine. That might be something that we're saying it isn't the standard of care at the moment. Is that correct, Dr. Delaney?
That's correct. If the other physicians want to comment, I would welcome their comments.
I agree with Dr. Delaney. I think that there are centers that do try to offer treatments that are not standard. And I think the first question that we all should pose as clinicians, as patients, and as family is, what are the data to support this compared to standard accepted treatments? Although we agree that we don't have perfect treatments for every different subtype of sarcoma, at least what the larger centers tend to recommend are treatments that they may be the best available that we have, but they're based on data in sarcomas, and we try not to do anything that's experimental unless it's on a clinical trial on a protocol that has been approved by the institutions and is registered on the clinical trials websites.
Thank you. This is very helpful, and I think very helpful to our participants as well. We have another question from one of our online participants, and this question is, I'm going to direct this. It's a general, it looks like it's a radiation and surgery question. Could you review approach options for oligometastatic disease management, specifically initial approach, and then if response to initial approach, just timing for radiation therapy and surgery? So, Dr. Delaney, do you want to start with that one?
I think sarcoma is one of the early sites where we realized that patients may have a small number of metastatic sites of disease. We refer to that as oligometastatic disease. And the most common site in sarcomas for the extremity tumors is in the lungs. And there's a long history of surgical removal of lung metastases that can result in the cure of a proportion of patients. More recently, the development of stereotactic radiation has also been used for some patients, which in our center we will frequently start with surgery, and if patients have a recurrence after the surgical procedure, we'll then begin to consider stereotactic radiation, although some patients would prefer not to have surgery, in which case we would do the stereotactic radiation. Other sites of oligometastatic disease include tumor in the liver, and there are stereotactic radiation approaches. There are ablative approaches from diagnostic radiology where it's called thermal ablation. A probe is placed into the tumor in the liver, and it's heated and then ablated in that fashion. Surgery can also be used for removal of tumors in the liver. So I think increasingly as we define groups of patients who we are able to address local sites of metastatic disease with local treatments, this can be an option for patients.
Yeah, I would echo what Dr. Delaney said. I think, first of all, the data for any treatment of oligometastatic disease is not based on randomized clinical trial results. These are largely based on single institution retrospective studies where they report their own outcomes. You have to take sort of the data knowing that there's going to be an inherent bias. For instance, and I completely agree with everything you said, most of the data come from resection of metastases to the lung from sarcomas, mostly arising in the extremities, the arms and legs. But there's already an inherent bias in patients who are going to undergo surgery. They typically have a low number of metastases to begin with, so maybe 3 or 4 sites of tumor or less. So the results from that cannot be applied to someone who might have 8 or 10 sites of lung metastases. And when you look at the data, again, they're generally small studies. But what they've generally shown is that the people, amongst all the people you might consider for surgery, so again, people that already have a bias towards a lower disease overall volume, the ones that have a fewer number of tumors, that have had a longer period since the original diagnosis, probably will do better. The data for liver metastases is much less than it is for lung metastases, but again, the same principles would apply. surgery and chemotherapy are would be options. Radiation therapy, particularly in lung, where the SBRT techniques can really minimize toxicity to the rest of the lung are an option. For the liver, options such as radiofrequency ablation and radioembolization might be options as well. But again, these are not based on any randomized trial data. Having said that, many people get liver resections for metastatic colon cancer, and that's not based on any randomized trial data. So some techniques become accepted because the long-term results are good, even though they've never been compared head-to-head with just chemotherapy alone.
Thank you. And Dr. Thornton, did you want to add?
I always have the easy job because I come in at the end and everything's already been said. But, no, I think it's just another great, you know, take-home message to champion getting thee to a multidisciplinary center, because these are the kinds of things that are under debate. And, you know, it's one of the hardest things that we encounter with patients who do have oligometastatic disease. You know, sometimes it is appropriate to have that disease focused on either with the radiation oncology techniques or with surgery, and sometimes it's not. And that's really hard for patients, understandably, is to do something like watch and wait. And yet sometimes it's entirely the appropriate thing to do.
I have a question, Dr. Thornton, just to ask. Is it appropriate for people to call the Center for Sarcoma and Bone Oncology, no matter where they live, just to kind of get help with identifying a center? Or do we often direct people to the National Cancer Institute as well, to their call center? Is there a preference around that in terms of the sarcoma? Which would you?
Yeah, there's a number of things that one can do. I mean, they can reach out to a center like here, and our new patient coordinators can help direct patients either to, you know, making an in-person appointment, or, you know, we have a mechanism in place to do remote second opinions that doesn't involve somebody traveling, but also reaching out. You mentioned in the very, very beginning of the phone call, some of the groups that you've worked with, Sarcoma Federation of America, Sarcoma Alliance. These are advocacy groups that can work with patients and on identifying different centers that might be closer to patients' homes. The Sarcoma Alliance for Research and Collaboration is a cooperative sarcoma group that we're all involved with, and I believe SARC's website has the different centers scattered across the United States and internationally that can help guide patients to appropriate places. And then each of the disease types, you know, Dr. Rout talked about how, you know, in essence, this is over 70 different types of cancer, and each one is unique. And so there's patient advocacy groups that are geared towards just angiosarcoma or just leiomyosarcoma, and those advocacy groups can be really helpful.
The SARC's website, do you have that website that we can just, because we're going to send everyone information that we've covered. So I just wanted to, there's a website that you can.
I would just Google it, Sarcoma Alliance for Research and Collaboration. It'll be, you know, the only one in there.
Okay, excellent. So this is excellent. I want to thank our speakers. You've really been extraordinary. And this has been really just an amazing call. I also, having a team of experts who actually work together in a center that is dedicated to soft tissue sarcoma, it makes all the difference in the world. Certainly they know each other. It just really works really well. I want to thank all of you. I also want to thank all of you who have asked such great questions, both on the telephone and online, and all of you who have been listening. So I did say that we would give you places to call, because I know there are questions that we didn't get to answer. So I'm going to give you some suggested places to call as the call ends, and then we are going to send that information to you as well. Some of you have gotten the information already, but just in case you haven't. So we often recommend, clearly we have two organizations that have partnered with us in today's program, the Sarcoma Alliance and the Sarcoma Foundation of America. So we will send you their information, and plus I will send you the information also that Dr. Thornton has shared as well. We will put that together for you. In addition, we do often recommend that people do call the National Cancer Institute. Their information specialists are always there, 1-800-422-6237, for any medical questions you may have. Also, you can visit their website at cancer NIH.gov, and they actually do have a wonderful chat feature for those of you who wish to actually just pose your question and really work with someone in a chat way, getting answers to your questions as well, or help with directing you. And, of course, we also have the great expertise of the center that our speakers have actually been speaking from, and that is a great resource to all of you on the call today. So this is the Center for Sarcoma and Bone Oncology, and actually we will send you that information as well. And, of course, the concept of having remote second opinion, all the different ways that you can work with these expert centers is really so important. And clearly I think the takeaway message is it's ideal that you would have some connection to a center that is treating a large number of people who have a similar health issues as you do in terms of sarcoma. And then if any of you wish to join a support group or contact Cancer Care in terms of talking to one of our oncology social workers, again, you also can start with your own healthcare team. I guess I want to go back to that, that if you, some of the information you learned today, we hope you'll take it back to your treating healthcare team, and they can also help to direct you. And there may be staff there that can help you also in kind of thinking about, you know, the best treatment for you. But also, some people do contact Cancer Care for support, talk to one of our oncology social workers, join one of our online or telephone support groups, access practical financial assistance from us, and also join other programs that we may be offering that may be of help to you. So most important, and also, of course, the Sarcoma Foundation of America and the Sarcoma Alliance, those are resources you have already that are on all the materials that you've received from us, and we'll receive them again. Most importantly, though, as we conclude today, we don't want anyone on this call to feel that you're alone. We want you to know that you're part of a number of organizations that can help you, and that we're all really simply a telephone call away or a website away to you and to bring the information and getting that support. So I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I'm going to wish you a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's workshop. This does conclude the program, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.